Please turn to the book of Zechariah, and I will read the entirety of Zechariah 12 and going on to chapter 13 and verse 1. And the verse that will be our focus today is Zechariah 12 and verse 10. But let's read the entire context together. The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. Thus declares the Lord, who stretched out the heavens and founded the earth and formed the spirit of man within him. Behold, I am about to make Jerusalem a cup of staggering to all the surrounding peoples. The siege of Jerusalem will also be against Judah. On that day I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will surely hurt themselves. And all the nations of the earth will gather against it. On that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with panic and its rider with madness. But for the sake of the house of Judah, I will keep my eyes open when I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah shall say to themselves, the inhabitants of Jerusalem have strength through the Lord of hosts, their God. On that day, I will make the clans of Judah like a blazing pot in the midst of wood, like a flaming torch among sheaves, and they shall devour to the right and to the left all the surrounding peoples, while Jerusalem shall again be inhabited in its place in Jerusalem. And the Lord will give salvation to the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem may not surpass that of Judah. On that day the Lord will protect the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so the feeblest among them on that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord going before them. And on that day I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child and weep bitterly over him, as one weeps over a firstborn. On that day the mourning in Jerusalem will be as great as the mourning for Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. The land shall mourn, each family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Nathan by itself and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Levi by itself and their wives by themselves, the family of the Shimeites by itself and their wives by themselves, and all the families that are left, each by itself, and their wives by themselves. On that day there shall be a fountain opened for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness. Well, our thoughts this morning are directed to the importance of praying for the outpouring of the Spirit. And the verse that we are really kind of setting as a banner over all that we want to say and think about is verse 10 of that chapter, that the verse that speaks of God pouring out upon Israel a spirit of grace and of supplication. In 1678, an English Puritan by the name of John Howe, probably one of the last figures that you can accurately describe as a Puritan, in terms of at least his historical context, he would die in 1705. In 1678, John Howe preached a series of sermons on Ezekiel 39, especially verse 29, a passage that also deals with the outpouring of the Spirit. In one of the sermons, he told his audience these words, "When the Spirit shall be poured forth plentifully, I believe you will hear much other kind of sermons, or they will, who shall live to such a time than you'll want to do nowadays. It is plain, too sadly plain, that there is a great retraction of the Spirit of God even from us. We do not know how to speak living sense, that is, felt reality, onto souls, how to get within you. Our words die in our mouths or drop and die between you and us. We even faint when we speak. Long experienced unsuccessfulness makes us despond. We speak not as persons that hope to prevail. When such an effusion of the Spirit shall be as is here signified, ministers shall know how to speak to better purpose, with more compassion and sense, with more seriousness, with more authority and allurement than we now find we can. That statement is probably not an isolated one. And if he, as a Puritan preacher, lamenting the state, especially of the capital of England at the time, London, felt things were bad in his day, by the time that he died in 1705, things had gotten a lot worse. The final decades of the 17th century, saw a distinct decline on every level of life, especially in public morals. One can find this decline attested to in various forms, in sermons like John Howe, but not only in sermons. Sometimes it's been said, well, preachers are always bewailing, lamenting the state of the times. But if you go through other documents, private diaries and journals and letters, not written for public consumption, as it were, they also lamented the great decline in public morals and the nature of public life. Here is one man, a London Baptist pastor, Benjamin Keach, very well known in his own day, probably the most important Baptist theologian on both sides of the Atlantic in the last 20 years of the 1600s. This is Keach, based in London, writing in 1701. One could update the language a little, amazingly, and it would fit our day, at least parts of the North America, very well. Was ever sodomy so common in a Christian nation, or so notoriously and frequently committed as by two palpable evidences it appears to be in and about this city? Is it not a wonder the patience of God hath not consumed us in his wrath before this time? Was ever swearing, blasphemy, whoring, drunkenness, gluttony, self-love at such a height as at this time here? The things he lists here, there was very little improvement over the next three decades. In fact, it's not until the 1730s that things begin to change for the better. The moral tone of the nation had sunk to great depths. One often can point to this in terms of its leadership. The man who was King of England, George I, who reigned from 1714 to 1727, it was said he was primarily interested in three things in life: food, horses, and women. When he arrived to take the throne of England, he arrived not with his lawful wedded wife, but with two mistresses. The man who was the first Prime Minister of England, the man who one can actually designate and say, this man starts that long line of Prime Ministers of England. The first man who can actually be called a Prime Minister, Robert Walpole, from 1722 to 1742, lived in undisguised adultery with his mistress. The only blessing of the situation was that when his wife did die, he did marry her. In that period, secular historians could note that even aristocratic women made no pretense of virtue, and having lovers and mistresses was regarded as a matter of commonplace and gossip, not a matter of reproach. And what was going on at the top of the social ladder, so to speak, was also happening completely unchecked at lower levels. Social conditions were bleak. It was the period in which Britain was becoming the first industrialized nation of the world, and large numbers of people were being shepherded, or herded, maybe is a better word, from their context in which they had lived in small villages and a rural context in large urban centers that were beginning to mushroom. It's interesting, at the beginning of the 18th century, London was probably around 1 million people, huge megalopolis, largest city in the world at the time. The next largest city was Norwich, or as we might say here in North America, Norwich, around 10,000 people. That tells you immediately that at the beginning of the 1700s, this was mostly a nation of small villages, rural, in its larger economy. By the end of that century, you had had mushroomed cities, places like Birmingham and Leeds and Liverpool and Bristol, many of them boasting 400,000 people. And the growth had been spectacular in terms of the size of these cities, but at enormous human cost. And men and women who had spent their lives and their parents and their forebears in specific locales in the country where they had had deep roots, roots that went down as deep into the soil as, say, the roots of an oak tree, were uprooted and forced to live in often situations of bleakness and horror, really, with very little adequate facilities to support human life. The pictures that Charles Dickens gives us of the mid-Victorian era, it's after the period I'm talking about, but it well depicts, he's not exaggerating, so the horrors of urban life in England during this period. And not surprisingly, many people turn to other outlets to find relief from their situation. And probably the most horrific was drink. Up until the 1700s, beer was probably the most common staple drink. In the 1700s, there is invented that horror of drink called gin. It's estimated that in London alone, about 100,000 people, this is one writer at the time, 100,000 people drank gin as their principal means of sustenance. In one little area, it's amazing the sort of ability of historians today to do some studies of the past. In one area of about 2,000 houses, it was estimated 500 of them, a quarter of them, were gin shops. In other words, taverns or pubs. One of the things that does strike you, I grew up in England and frequently go back, one of the things that still strikes me is how many pubs there are. It looks like every street corner has got one. And they go back. They go back into the 18th century. And drunkenness became a major national problem during this period. Now, when you turn to the church situation, one would think, well, what was the church doing? 90% of the people in England belonged to the established church, the Church of England. It was utterly unable to cope with a radically changing situation. Many of the ministers in the Church of England were in country parishes, and the last place they wanted to go was into the city. Many of the towns like Leeds, which grew within the space of about 50 years from 5,000 people to 150,000 people, was regarded by the Church of England as one parish. There was one minister to look after the whole thing. Not surprisingly, many of these ministers, because of the horrors socially of the inner cities, refused to go into these cities and establish new parishes. Many of these ministers themselves were not what we would describe even as Christians. They had become ministers for a variety of reasons, sometimes second, third sons of aristocratic families who didn't have any future because all of the estate would be entailed upon the eldest son. And so what were they going to do? They had a choice of two professions, the army, navy, or into the church. And many of them chose to go into the church. The church would give them a secure living. It'd give them all kinds of free time. I don't know how many ministers you can go through who are converted in the 18th century, who became ministers because it gave them all kinds of free time. All they had to do was rattle together a little homily for Sunday, 10 minutes in length, and the rest of the week was theirs unless somebody died or had to get married. And one thinks of men like Thomas Chalmers, who would be converted in the early 1800s, or William Grimshaw. William Grimshaw, the great evangelist in Yorkshire, converted before the Great Awakening. He became a minister because, as I said, it gave him all kinds of time to play cards and drink. He said he tried to keep his recreations from his congregation, but that's why he became a minister. Among the higher ranks of the Church of England, things were a little better. Many of them are described as worldly men. Here is one man, an historian, J.H. Plum. He's not a Christian. He's got no perspective to emphasize. He could say, "There is a worldliness about 18th century bishops which no amount of apologetics can conceal. Their clerical duties were done only as political duties allowed." Not surprisingly, Some of the men and women who sat under the preaching of these individuals, who were godly individuals, recognized the problem. Here's one man. He was a shopkeeper. He kept a journal, which has survived. A man named Thomas Turner, listening to some of the preaching of the man who preached in his parish, he said it was an idle, lazy way of preaching, which many of our clergy have gotten into, rather seeming to make self-interest the motive for their exercising their profession than the eternal happiness and salvation of men's souls, to which, if we add the intolerable degree of pride and covetousness in predominant in too many of our clergy, we need not wonder at our degeneracy from the piety of our forefathers who worshiped God in the first ages of Christianity. Now, there was one group that should have been able to rectify this situation. They were the children of the Puritans, the men and women who had been actually forced out of the Church of England in the 1660s and had splintered into three major groups, the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, and the Calvinistic Baptists. And they should have been able to provide a spiritual response to this situation. But for a variety of reasons, they were unable to do so. The Presbyterians, who had included in their early days such men as Richard Baxter and John Howe, whom I just read, and Samuel Ainslie, the grandfather of John and Charles Wesley, by the mid-18th century were completely liberal. This one denomination who in the 1670s and 1680s had been the strongest Puritan denomination, by the 1730s to 1750s had completely lost its way in the bogs of Unitarianism. And they ceased to be a force for spiritual renewal or even orthodoxy in England from that point forward. Any Presbyterian church over on this side of the Atlantic has its roots in Scottish Presbyterianism and not English Presbyterianism. The other two groups, the Congregationalists and the Calvinistic Baptists, they were orthodox. There's no doubt about that. They were men and women who held on to the basic essentials of biblical Christianity. But for a variety of reasons, which it would take us too far afield to get into in great detail, they too were unable to speak a winning message to their day. Many of the Calvinistic Baptists, for example, who we were looking at yesterday, who had flourished during a time of persecution in the 1670s and 1680s, and whose churches probably in 1689 numbered around 300 in England, by 1715 were down to 220, and by 1750 they were down to 150. And the statistics tell you that there was decline going on. The decline is owing to a number of factors, one of which is what we would describe as hyper-Calvinism. They began with the Calvinistic biblical position that when it comes to the gospel, it is God who saves sinners. Salvation is a work of God from beginning to end. But then they reasoned from that if that is the case, then in terms of the offer of the gospel, it should be quite clear that it is God who saves sinners and the preacher is not actually saving anyone. And so the offer of the gospel was often truncated or restricted. And you have men who are preaching biblical orthodoxy in certain areas, but they are not offering the gospel. There is no allurement, as John Howe said, in their preaching. A man like Andrew Fuller, who will come into our story a little bit today, grew up under a man called John Eve. By the time that Fuller was 16 or 17, he said, I had completely turned him off. I never listened to a word he said from the pulpit because he had not a word to say to the unconverted. In his entire time in that church, he had gone there from a very young boy. He never heard one word from the pulpit that addressed him as an unconverted sinner. And Eve had fallen into a habit of refusing to urge the lost passionately to respond to the gospel. He could reason theologically that because it was God who saved sinners, saved the elect, you offer the gospel to a non-elect person, you have no promise that God obviously is going to save that person. Therefore, it's offering the proverbial carrot to the donkey. You want the donkey to do something, you hang the carrot in front of its nose. You're not going to allow the donkey to eat the carrot until it does what you want to do. And that sort of argument, that the elect are not going to be saved. How can you offer the gospel to the elect? And rather than offer the gospel to somebody who's among the non-elect, the gospel was not offered at all. Obviously, as you're well aware, that is not the business of the preacher. When he stands behind the pulpit, it is not his responsibility to try to determine who is among the elect in his congregation or not. And so there was spiritual decline. There are other reasons why, and we, as I said, could get into them, but it would take us too far afield. And so it's not surprising that the Baptists, Calvinistic Baptists, who could have offered a winning message in their day, found themselves stymied, stagnated, and in spiritual decline. Andrew Fuller, who I earlier referred to, said that if matters had gone on much longer, the Baptist would have become, he had grown up as a farmer, little more than a dunghill in society. In the 1730s, Isaac Watts, who you know well as the father of English hymnody, and another man named John Guys, in their publication of a little book that had come into their hands by an unknown American preacher named Jonathan Edwards, a book called A Faithful Narrative of a Surprising Work of God in the Conversion of Sinners, that they had seen through the press in 1736. In the introduction of that book, they prayed this prayer. There has been a great and just complaint for many years that the work of conversion goes on very slowly. The Spirit of God and His saving influences is much withdrawn from the ministry of the Word, and there are few that receive the report of the gospel with any eminent success upon their hearts. Return, O Lord, visit Thy churches, and revive Thy work in the midst of us. That was in 1737 when they penned that prayer. Already God, unbeknown to them, had begun to answer that prayer. They would find it difficult to believe the answer, because the answer came not among their circles. They were not the only ones praying this. If you actually read the diaries again and some of the sermons of Baptist and Congregationalist ministers in the 1720s and 1730s, you start to realize these men and women have realized the direness of their situation. And a number of them are starting now to pray the Lord to outpour the Spirit. But the answer didn't come in the way that they expected. It came in quite a surprising way. It did not come among these men and women who had retained biblical orthodoxy, by and large, but it came among the Church of England. It came among those who had persecuted the grandparents of men like Watts and Guys. Isaac Watts, in some of his earliest memories, were going to a prison in Southampton, where his father, a deacon of the Congregationalist Church in Southampton, spent time in prison for his views on biblical church government and his refusal to join the Church of England. It's not surprising that many of the men and women, when revival comes, and that's what we're talking about, in the 1730s, had difficulty accepting it. And one needs to be, I think, sympathetic to where they stood. Their parents and grandparents had suffered at enormous cost to pass on a rich heritage of what we would describe as a biblical understanding of church government, and in the form of the Calvinistic Baptist, a biblical understanding of believers' baptism. And when revival does come, and they are in the middle of it, one can well understand why they looked on it with initially amazement, shock, and to some degree, disbelief. Because in the mid-1730s, the flames of revival began to be seen in England and Wales. If we had time to trace it, it actually goes back into the 1720s among German-speaking Moravians. But among English-speaking, it first appears in Wales with the conversion of two men, Howell Harris and Daniel Rowland. Daniel Rowland is your typical Anglican minister who had become a minister for many other reasons but for the sake of the gospel
in the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ. On an amazing occasion when he invited, and how he came to invite this man is not known, a man named Griffith Jones into his pulpit. Griffith Jones, who was an evangelical, well knew the state of the minister's heart, and in his sermon that day, before he preached that day, he prayed publicly that God would convert the minister of the church in which he was preaching, Daniel Roland. And Roland was brought under deep conviction that issued in a sound conversion. And he became, for God, one of the most remarkable preachers of the gospel in the 18th century. Probably more remarkable than even the great George Whitefield. Unfortunately, we know little of Roland's preaching today because he was probably a monoglot. He could only speak Welsh. And very, very few of his sermons have been translated into English. There is a great life of him done by Ifean Evans, Daniel Roland, and the Great Awakening. Hal Harris also converted at that time, and these men would become vehicles of God's reviving work, Spirit's reviving work in Wales. On the other side of the Atlantic, in an obscure town, most important town west of Boston, but still an obscure town on the fringes of the British Empire, you need to remember that Jonathan Edwards, if you'd asked him what he was, he would have told you he was an Englishman. We know him as an American, but he would have regarded himself as an Englishman. And the American War of Independence does not take place until he's been dead at least nearly 20 years. In an obscure town called Northampton, 1,000 people or so, 300 families, God brings revival from December of 1734 to June of 1735, in which Edwards would estimate about 300 men and women and children down to the age of 4, I'm thinking there of a woman, a little girl called Phoebe Bartlett, were converted. And he started to see the answers to many of the prayers of his forebears who had prayed for revival. In a letter that the Welsh evangelist Howell Harris wrote to George Whitefield, Whitefield also was converted in 1735. Probably the man who bound together this enormous work of God, he traveled across the Atlantic 13 times in a day in which it took 6 to 8 weeks to travel one way, who died in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and was buried there just north of Boston. A man who preached in probably pretty well every town in England, most of the villages, and there were two Englishmen known to every American by the time of his death in 1770, the King, George III, who wasn't liked, and the other George, Whitefield, who was passionately loved by Americans. This is the way Howell Harris wrote to George Whitefield in 1743, describing what God was doing. "The outpouring of the Blessed Spirit is now so plentiful and common, I think it was our deliberate observation that not one sent by the Spirit opens his mouth without some remarkable showers. The Spirit comes either as a spirit of wisdom to enlighten the soul, to teach and build up and set out the works of light and darkness. Or he comes as a spirit of tenderness and love, sweetly melting souls like the dew and watering the graces. Or he comes as a spirit of hot burning zeal, setting hearts aflame so that eyes sparkle with fire, love, and joy. Or he comes as a spirit of such uncommon power that the heavens seem to be rent and hell to tremble." And during the 1730s and the 1740s, God anointed by his spirit, the labors of men like Whitefield and Edwards and Samuel Davies in Virginia and the Tennants and Henry Venn and John Newton and William Grimshaw. And the list goes on and on and on. Significant numbers of whom, Edwards was not obviously, but significant numbers of whom were Anglicans. And the Calvinistic Baptists had deep problems with what was happening. First of all, these men, some of them were Arminian, like the Wesleys. And they were therefore beyond the pale theologically. Others of them, like Whitefield, he claimed to be a Calvinist, but when he preached, he sure sounded to many Calvinistic Baptists like an Arminian because he urged passionately, often with tears, the lost to come to Christ. Most importantly, and I don't think it's the hyper-Calvinism that stopped them, most importantly, these men were the children of those who had persecuted the forebears of these Baptists. And they knew that they had been given a rich heritage in the forms of their churches. One that their parents and grandparents had shed blood for. Were they to throw that over and therefore say that all these Anglican ministers who were preaching the gospel so powerfully were rights in their church, form of church government? And so, not surprisingly, many Calvinistic Baptists stood aloof from the revival, not only in England, but also over here in Massachusetts, for example, and New England. Many of the oldest Baptist churches that had been founded there had suffered terribly at the hands of the Puritan establishment. They too stood aloof from the revival to some degree. I think it's easy to look back and say what they should have done, but I think what they could have done is the way that they could have viewed what was happening in their day, the way that they viewed men like Calvin and Luther. When they looked at the remarkable men of the Reformation, they recognized these men had the core of the gospel. They didn't have a biblical understanding of church government or believers' baptism, but they had the core of the gospel. They needed more light. And I think what they should have done is looked at men like Whitfield and Venn and Grimshaw and these others, and Roland and Harris in their day, and said, these men have the core of the gospel. They preach the biblical understanding of salvation, but they need more light. And we can support and pray for their endeavors without endorsing their form of church government. But they didn't do so. And it's not until the 1770s that God brings revival among the Baptists in England. Now, things had changed by that time already over here. You know something of the story of the emergence of those called separate Baptists and men like Schubel Stearns and Daniel Marshall and the ministry down in the Carolinas and Georgia, or Isaac Backus in New England. Things had begun to change here before they began to change in England, but I want to think with you about the British Isles. Not until the 1770s, things begin to change, and no wonder Andrew Fuller could say, all around them was revival. Anglican churches flourishing, and the Baptists are dying and declining. Revival comes in the 1770s and 1780s. Again, it comes along a number of lines. It comes when God raises up Andrew Fuller and he begins to look into the scriptures and realizes that many of his contemporaries are not freely offering Christ to sinners. They're in shackles in the pulpit trying to determine, are the people in front of me, are some of them among the elect or not among the elect? And God's people are in shackles because they were given the idea by many of their preachers, the first thing you need to figure out when you hear the gospel is, am I among the elect? If you are among the elect, then you can respond to the Lord Jesus Christ. In other words, I have to look within, first of all, to determine, am I among the elect? If I'm among the elect, then I can go to Christ and ask him to save me. That's backwards, it strikes me. That's what many God's people were in shackles over because of the preaching. And many of them were also sitting at ease, as Ed Fuller would say, in Zion. They would be sitting in congregations under the sound of the gospel that was not being fully offered and saying, I'd love to get saved. When God saves me, it'll be fabulous. But until that point, I'm stuck. And so Andrew Fuller would write a book called The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, published in the mid-1780s, that was like a revolutionary firing of a cannon. And it would become a major turning point in Baptist history. But there was something else that I want to look at, and that is men and women praying for an outpouring of the Spirit. And the man who's often linked with that is a man named John Sutcliffe, who was born in 1752. He died in 1814. He was born in in the area that we know as Yorkshire in England. He was trained as a minister, trained for ministry at Bristol Baptist Academy, the only seminary at the time in the British Isles for training Baptist ministers. He came eventually in 1775 to a little village called Olney. It's well known today because Olney was where John Newton and William Cooper were living at the very time John Sutcliffe came to be the Baptist minister. And in the course of time, a good friendship would develop between Sutcliffe and these two Anglicans. And one can see something of the change that was taking place in Baptist thinking to some degree, because on New Year's Day and New Year's Eve, they would actually preach from each other's pulpits. In 1784, Sutcliffe was given a book. It was written by Jonathan Edwards. How the book came into his hands is an interesting story. One of the Scottish ministers who was one of Edwards' closest correspondents, a man named John Erskine, a young man when Edwards was at the height of his ministry, a young man who saw revival at a place called Cams Lang, just outside Glasgow, or as we would spell it, Cambus Lang, in the 1740s, when a Lord's Supper in the Church of Scotland turned into a full-fledged revival that lasted for probably 2 months every night, seeing probably 7,000 to 10,000 people coming to hear the preaching of the gospel. And Erskine had seen this, and he'd begun to correspond with Jonathan Edwards, and Edwards sent him a number of his books and manuscripts, and Erskine became a lifelong, ardent publisher of Edwards' books. And it was in 1784 he sent a book that found its hands into the hands of John Sutcliffe, and it was called A Humble Attempt. That's the way the book is remembered briefly. The full title, this is typical of an 18th century book, A Humble Attempt to Promote Explicit Agreement and Visible Union of God's People in Extraordinary Prayer for the Revival of Religion, we haven't got to the end of it yet, and the Advancement of Christ's Kingdom on Earth Pursuant to Scripture Promises and Prophecies Concerning the Last Time. No wonder you find people call it The Humble Attempt. And the book was a series of messages Edwards preached on a passage from Zechariah. Zechariah is, by the way, one of the most important books of the Old Testament in the history of the church. And Zechariah 8, 20 to 22, Edwards had preached a series of sermons pleading for men and women of his day to gather together in small groups and as churches to pray for revival. It was probably not until the 1780s that that book had its deepest impact. John Sutcliffe read the book, was deeply moved by it, and at a minister's association in June of 1784, proposed to a small association of churches known as the Northamptonshire Association. Most of the ministers were bivocational ministers, men whose churches could not support them, men who would maybe keep shop, keep a school, or men like, as one of the men who became a minister in this group of people, William Carey, who are cobblers, as well as being ministers. And in June of 1784, Sutcliffe proposed the following, that there would be a call to prayer, that regularly, and times of the year were set out, for 1 hour on the first Monday evening every month, God's people in this Association of Baptists would pray for revival. This is the way the last two paragraphs of this prayer call read. The grand object in prayer is to be that the Holy Spirit may be poured down on our ministers and churches, sinners converted, the saints edified, the interest of religion revived, and the name of God glorified. At the same time, remember, we trust you'll not confine your requests to your own churches or to your own immediate denomination. Let the whole interest of the Redeemer be affectionately remembered, and the spread of the gospel to the most distant parts of the habitable globe be the object of your most fervent requests. We shall rejoice if any other Christian societies of our own or other denomination will unite with us, and do now invite them most cordially to join heart and hand to the attempt. Who can tell what the consequences of such a united effort in prayer may be? Let us plead with God the many gracious promises of his word, which relate to the future success of his gospel. He has said, I will yet for this be inquired of, but the house of Israel to do it for them. I will increase them with men like a flock. Ezekiel 36:37. Surely we have love enough for Zion to set apart 1 hour at a time, 12 times in a year, to seek her welfare. Before I make 4 points about this little statement I've read, you need to know that this prayer call and the positive response of the churches to it is the beginning of what is called the Second Great Awakening, which was a deeper, more profound work of revival than the First Great Awakening associated with the names of Edwards, Whitfield, and the Wesleys. The Second Great Awakening here in the United States would begin roughly 1792. It was still going over 40 years later when Charles Finney goes to upstate New York and preaches in places like Albany and Rome and Utica. It was a very deep, profound work of God that reshaped society in the English-speaking world on both sides of the Atlantic. And it begins with a group of Baptists, poor by the most part, small village-oriented Baptists who respond positively to pray for revival 12 times a year for an hour on the first Monday evening of the month. 4 points. The first thing is these men and women are very aware that any reversal of their states of their churches can only come by God, from God. They are under no illusion that to change the fortunes or the future of their churches, they must resort to mere human zeal and techniques and programs. But it must be the Spirit of God. Here's John Sutcliffe on another occasion. The outpouring of the divine Spirit is the great promise of the New Testament. His influences are the soul, the great animating soul of all religion. These withheld divine ordinances are empty cisterns and spiritual graces, withering flowers. Without the Spirit, the greatest human abilities labor in vain, and noblest efforts fail of success. The second thing to note about this statement is what I would describe it as, its catholicity. These men and women are being urged, don't simply pray for your own churches, but remember the entire work of the Redeemer. One of the things that these Baptists are awakening to, and it was a difficult thing for them to come to, is to recognize that not all of those whom God was using in the kingdom went under the name of Baptists. That there were others, godly men and women. They may not agree with them in church polity, but godly men and women whose ministries God was blessing. Men like John Newton and William Cooper. If you go to Olney, it's a market town, and therefore has a large town square. This is even true today, where people would gather on Wednesday afternoons and Saturdays to sell their market goods. On one side of the square is the house of William Cooper, still stands today as a museum. In fact, you can go into it and go up through the back and into the backyard and see a little shed that he used to often go out to, and where he'd have time of conversation with John Newton, who'd cut through the back of the garden from his church in the manse where he lived, only a few hundred yards away, and where Cooper often wrote many of his poems. Cooper could come out his front door and look at maybe 150 yards over the town square, and he could see the Baptist church where John Sutcliffe was. And these men knew rich fellowship together. And some of the richest descriptions we have of Baptist life in Olney come from the hands of William Cooper's letters, who would describe how often the Baptists would have their association meeting in his backyard, because there was a field beyond his backyard. He'd sometimes go over there and listen to the preaching. Yesterday, you may have noticed, John Newton did that on one occasion. He heard Benjamin Bedham preach. These sorts of going back and forth between Baptist and Anglican were completely unknown to their grandparents. For them, Anglicans were the enemy. And so there is a Catholicity here. They're not simply to pray for their own churches, but the whole interest of the Redeemer. Thirdly, there is a missionary emphasis. It's amazing how the situation of the church has so radically changed in the last 200 years. When these men and women started to pray that God would send the gospel to the ends of the earth, in terms of evangelical Christianity, it was mostly in two areas of the world. It was in Northern Europe and along the Atlantic seaboard on this side of the Atlantic. But since that, there are now more evangelicals in countries in Africa and Asia and Latin America than there are in the so-called West. And unless God visits us with revival, it'll continue to be that way. And then finally, these men and women know that there is biblical grounds for praying for the outpouring of the Spirit. The passage they mention is not Zechariah 12, which they could have mentioned, but they mention many, but they choose one in particular, Ezekiel 36, 37. It's a passage in which God predicts through the prophet Ezekiel that he will return his people from exile in Babylon to Israel. But God says, before I do this for them, I will yet be inquired of them. In other words, God's promise to bring Israel back from exile, but before he does so, he will stir his people up to pray that God would do this. And these Baptists rightly discerned in there is a biblical principle, which is that before God does anything for his church, he stirs his people to prayer. They rightly recognize we vainly long for revival if we are not willing to pray for revival. They rightly understood there is no revival without prayer. They did not believe, as Charles Finney would later argue, that if you pray, it'll come. That prayer automatically brings revival. They are far too biblical to know that or to believe that. But they did believe, and this also biblically, there is no hope of revival if we do not gather corporately and pray. And so beginning in 1784, they began to devote 1 hour, not enormously long prayer meetings, but 1 hour to pray on the first Monday evening of the month in small groups, in their churches, sometimes singly because people live too far from the church for revival. In the early years, they didn't see anything, really. In fact, they saw the opposite. They saw increasing decline. But then they started to see God begin to work in their midst. In 1789, a very interesting year in European history, the year of the French Revolution, in 1789, John Sutcliffe reprinted Andrew Fuller's Humble Attempt, and he had a little preface at the beginning of it, in which he said, "I don't believe in some of Edwards's eschatology, his view of the future," because Edwards had linked that very much to revival. But he says these things: "The advocates of error are indefatigable in their endeavors to overthrow the distinguishing doctrines of Christianity. These doctrines, which are the grounds of our hope and sources of our joy, surely it becomes the followers of Christ to use every effort in order to strengthen the things which remain. In the present imperfect state, we may reasonably expect a diversity of sentiments upon religious matters. Each ought to think for himself. Everyone has a right on proper occasions to show his opinion." What he's talking about there is the differences between Anglican, Baptist, and Methodist, for example, in their church polity. But, he says, we should all remember there are but two parties in the world, each engaged in opposite causes, the cause of God and Satan, of holiness and sin, of heaven and hell. The advancement of the one, the downfall of the other, must appear exceedingly desirable to every real friend of God and man. If such, in some respects, entertain worship in different ways, surely they may unite in the above business of prayer. For thousands upon thousands, divided into small bands in their united prayers, bring prayers before God, and their prayers ascend like clouds of incense before the Most High. May he shower down blessings upon all the scattered tribes of Zion. John Sutcliffe was a very strong Baptist, and there was no way he was going to give up his convictions regarding believers' baptism. But he recognized that there was something more important than believers' baptism and Baptist polity, and it was the advance of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And he could pray with those of whom he disagreed in terms of polity that God would bring revival. Revival comes in among these Baptists. It is, as I said, the beginning of a remarkable work of God that spread from these small groups in England to become a massive work that we call the Second Great Awakening. It is in this, among this body of people, as they are praying that God would send, well, God would send the gospel to the ends of the earth, God raises up among them a man who would do that, William Carey. In 1784, Carey was actually just on the verge of becoming a Baptist. He was not even part of the initial praying for revival, but he eventually does join these churches. John Sutcliffe is his first pastor, who teaches him Latin and Greek, and gets Carey off in that incredibly fruitful ministry of translation that would be see such rich fruit in India. In the mid-1790s, a London Baptist minister named John Rippon drew up a list of congregations in England and Wales, Baptist churches, and he came to the conclusion that there were over 380. 50 years earlier, there were 150. And as you move into the 19th century, what you see is enormous growth. Among one congregation, let's just take very quickly Andrew Fuller. Andrew Fuller, who had come to a church in Kettering, where there had been about 150 to 170 members, by the end of his ministry, God was so richly blessing, he was preaching regularly to congregations of well over 1,000. And they had to institute two or three meetings on weeknights for young people. He tells Carey on a number of occasions, last night I preached to 1,000 young people. And this is in a town of 3,000. And those meetings were regularly, every week for quite a while. And he says, they were there because they were in dire concern about the state of their souls. When John Sutcliffe was dying in 1814, Andrew Fuller went to visit him. And he heard these very odd words from Fuller's mouth. I wish I had prayed more. Fuller thought long and hard on this statement of his dying friend, and eventually he came to the conclusion what he meant was he didn't wish he had prayed in terms of more time, more frequently, because Sutcliffe, he knew, was a man of regular, frequent prayer. But what he meant was he wished he had prayed more spiritually. And then he applied it to his own life. I wish I had prayed more for the influence of the Spirit. I might have enjoyed more the power of vital godliness. I wish I had prayed more for the assistance of the Spirit in studying and preaching my sermons. I might have seen more the blessing of God attending my ministry. This is a man, I've already said, was preaching regularly to 1,000 young people two or three times a week for a number of months. I wish I had prayed more for the outpouring of the Spirit to attend the labors of our friends in India. I might have witnessed more the effects of their efforts in the conversion of the heathen. What you have there is what Jonathan Edwards would regard as a holy dissatisfaction with the state of their spiritual life. But compared to us, these men are giants. We can learn from the past. I don't want to idolize these men. They had their faults and failings. But we can learn from the past. Our great need today is the outpouring of the Spirit. And as God did in that day, it was an answer to prayer. And we need to be fervent and committed as congregations to the life of prayer, pleading with God that he would come again, pour out his Spirit upon us individually, but especially upon our churches, that glory might come to the Lord Jesus Christ and his kingdom be advanced. Amen.